We'd like to convene the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Kahn, would you make a motion on the minutes?
Yes, it's the terrific minutes, and I move them.
They're very elegant.
Okay, Representative Kahn moves the approval of the minutes from May 5th. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried.
My peers review what
Ms. Connolly wanted me to mention, just so everybody understands, I think members do, maybe the audience doesn't. Yesterday we were in recess, but House rules provide that if you don't reconvene by midnight, the committee automatically adjourns. And so just so people understand relative to the minutes, that's what transpired yesterday. First item of business this morning is the budget resolution. And I'd like to bring the budget resolution back before us. And we will move the CSRES 06-3 as adopted on April 8th, 2014. I'll just simply bring that back before us. And so then I will move the CSRES 06-810 amendment. And what we're doing, I'll ask in a moment Mr. Marks to explain the transaction, but essentially we're going to have in that motion a moving of money or realigning the money for transportation to the Capital Investment Committee to get the funding level up to $200 million. So, Mr. Marks, could you explain what or give us those numbers and maybe add a little bit to what we're doing?
Mr. Chair, members, if you look at the spreadsheet that's in the packet with the resolution amendment, the last column shows the changes from the previous resolution. And as you go down, the transportation number is changed to $10 million, a reduction of $39,682. And then capital investment is increased to $200 million. That's an increase of $67,277. The difference available for other bills is increased by $2,819,000. That'll be the amount of the medical marijuana bill considered later. And then you can also see the previous resolution allowed $36 million on the bottom line. This reduction of $34,144 in this proposal. So the A10 amendment is placing the new numbers in on line 1.4. It's changing the total spending from $1,047,000,000, or the total change here from $1,047,000,000 to $1,077,000,000. Changing the capital investment number to $200 million and changing the transportation number to $10 million.
Okay, so that is the motion to amend the budget resolution. Then any discussion? Okay, seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion carried. The first bill on the agenda this morning then is the capital investment bill. And Representative Hausman, would you like to move the bill?
Mr. Chair, I think we're starting with 1068. I move that House File 1068 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration.
Okay. So Representative Hausman moves that House File 1068, the second engrossment, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration. So Representative Hausman, you have an amendment, the DE3 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I will move that.
And
this is...
would you care to move the amendment? Oh, you did move the amendment. Okay.
Oh.
No, she didn't.
No, she moved the bill.
Okay, you moved the amendment. Okay.
I will move the amendment. DE3 amendment.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and members, these are bills that you really need to view side by side. And because we just altered the budget resolution, I thought it was important to set these bills and amendments in the context of where we are in the process. It is certainly a moving target. What passed out of our committee were two bills. One, at that time, our targets were 850 GO bonding and 125 cash. Because it sounds as though we just got more cash in that budget resolution, I should give you a little bit of a sense of why that is not the case. The target for general obligation bonding was 850, now it is 846. So in that part of the bill, I need to cut an additional $4 million. In the cash bill, $125 million, there was only $15 million for the capital. And as you all know, we had to restore that, and so that was my first obligation. And so that $200 million gave me $75 million more. That entire $75 million went toward the capital. That only got me up to $90 million. And so from that existing cash bill, I had to cut another $36.3 million. So I will, at the end of today, have gone back to those two bills and cut another $40 million from it. And what we will have accomplished in that action is bringing up the capital to full funding. So that's the background to this. And, Mr. Chair, I think you have a busy schedule. Everybody has the spreadsheet. Perhaps we could just, I think there are two amendments that to this bill. Did you want to take those now?
Well, we would need to adopt the DE3 amendment. So any discussion on the DE3?
Oh, I should also say, I think there had been a hope when we passed those first bills out of committee that there would be a miracle, that there would be a resolve to break the agreement on the 850. That didn't happen, and that and I had hoped that there might be a little more cash. That didn't happen. And so at the end of last week, the Speaker advised that it was probably time to go back to last year's bill. That was the agreement, that votes, that the following year they would deliver votes for that bill with all their projects in. And so that's what we did to get ready for today. We went back to last year's bill for all the minority projects and dollar amounts, and that's the change you see before you.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Houseman, would you like to move the 821 amendment?
And as all of those things were happening this weekend, there are sometimes inadvertent problems. And the West St. Paul North Urban Regional Trail Bridge was inadvertently deleted, and so this amendment puts it back in with some adjustment to the other amounts.
Okay, so Representative Houseman moves the 821 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
And then I believe Representative Dabney.
Yeah, Representative Dabney. I think I'm somewhere.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the DDH1068820 amendment.
Okay, that motion is before us. Representative Dabney on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A120 assigns $3 million in the cash portion to the YWCA of Minneapolis for rehabbing the child care program building there. I can speak more fully, but the amendment also does require that the YWCA be able to match the $3 million dollar for dollar before the monies would flow. And they have reported to me that they already have commitments for that money. This is a program that serves children across the region from Elk River to Stillwater and Shakopee to Eagan, as well as doing curriculum development and training of child care workers across the state. I could speak more fully if members have questions.
And, Mr. Chair, I strongly support that amendment. In the original bill, I had $10 million, which would still be my preferred amount, and I hope somehow that that can still happen. And of that amount, $5 million was going to be designated for this project and $5 million for other additional. It is unique, as Representative Dabney describes it, because of its location and serving people all over. The thank you notes that I got, some came from Minneapolis, but they also came many from Edina and Plymouth and Woodbury and St. Paul. So it serves a broad group of people, and actually I think also has a great track record in developing young minds so that they are achievers when they reach school. I think the statistics are compelling about that, so I strongly support the amendment.
Okay, and Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, could you just talk just real quickly about where the money is coming from and where it's going within the amendment?
Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, this is in the cash portion of the capital investment proposal. It would go to rehab and remodel the building, both because of structural needs at this point, you know, new roof, things like that, normal that you would expect, as well as remodeling the facility to better meet their curriculum needs. As Chair Hausman was kind enough to report, there is no achievement gap in the outcomes for the YWCA. In the program, they have 68% of the children are low income. 62% of those live in families below the federal poverty line, primarily single parents. 64% of them come out of single parent households. 59% of them are children of color, and an additional 22% are multiracial. And yet, 93% of those kids are ready for kindergarten on our ready for kindergarten assessments. So a population that is disproportionately low income and yet overachieves compared to the 60% state average on ready for kindergarten. The YWCA not only has this facility, which is its flagship and where it develops its curriculum, but has six other facilities around the metro area, and as I indicated earlier, does curriculum development and training statewide in culturally competent curriculum for child care providers. So located in downtown Minneapolis, facilities across the metro area and a statewide reach.
And Mr. Chair, I believe Representative Dean might have been asking where in the bill the money comes from. And just to talk a little bit about that, the original bill had $10 million. The DE amendment lowered that to $5 million. Of that $10 million, $5 million had been designated for the Y project and $5 million for the remainder of the centers. Because we lowered that amount to $5 million in the DE amendment, what he's saying is of that $5 million, $3 million is designated for this project.
Thank you,
Representative Dean. Is that?
Yep.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. Representative Dabney renews his motion on the H-1068A20 amendment. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Okay, we have then the bill as amended before us. Any further discussion? Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess here we go again. We had some, in terms of military affairs and veterans affairs, came in requesting some asset preservation and some different things that had to be done at in both organizations with military affairs and veterans affairs. And I see veterans affairs, we've cut basically in half what they were requesting. I know talking to the people with veterans affairs, they were pretty conservative in their request. And now we're looking at spending millions of dollars into parks and trails where our veterans and our military affairs two organizations are in need of these asset preservations. So I'm pretty disappointed. I know our proposal that we put forward with our bonding bill at least put some more money into these two organizations, the Military Affairs and Veterans Affairs, so I am disappointed with this.
And, Mr. Chair, I believe he's speaking to the other bill that we haven't come to yet. This one, the only portion of this is, I think that must be the housing, that 250,000 housing.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the spreadsheet. So,
we'll in the other bill, we'll be dealing with the veterans.
Okay. Any further discussion, Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hausman, yesterday the governor had sent a letter to both, I believe, Senator Bach and Representative Thiessen with regards to his vision for both the cash and the geo bonding portions of the bill. How do you see this kind of moving forward together? You kind of talk about it moving together, moving to the floor, working with the legislative leaders and the governor to trying to get a final package.
Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, I hope that you and I are soon at a table with the governor or staff and the House and Senate together. You know, governor, House, Senate, Republicans, Democrats, we're so close to the end that we really all need to be at a table very, very soon. And I hope you and I have a lot of work to do very quickly.
Representative Beamer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hausman, this is a process question more than anything. And first of all, let me just say I appreciate the incredible work that the Capital Investment Committee does to assemble such a package when there's such incredible needs out in the state of Minnesota, and to be able and to have to pare this down to the amount of projects that actually get funding. But I have a process question as a fiscal chair that at least since I've been chair of the Public Safety Committee, it's always been the process that any bonding request that had to do with public safety, they get referred to the Public Safety Committee. The Public Safety Committee hears those requests. We prioritize them in the past. We've sent those recommendations on to you. So this year, there were five or six projects, I guess, that got sent to, well, some of them did get sent to the committee, some of them didn't. So I'm just wondering, I have no idea what the Cyrus Public Safety Building is. Frankly, I don't know where Cyrus is. I hope I'm not offending anybody from Cyrus, and I don't know where Montgomery is either. I know where Maplewood is. That's the only project. That's the only project that actually came before. Did I just offend a member? Did that? I don't know where it is. I'm sorry. I've lived in Minnesota all my life. the Maplewood project is actually was funded over the last 2 years, I believe, because so that we heard that one, and the Cottage Grove one we did not hear. So I guess the question is for future chairs, and I don't know if other chairs care about this or if they get bills referred to them. I would just ask the question, what's the point of referring them? Why should I waste the committee's time? Why should I waste my time? Why should I bring all of these people up, fire chiefs, police chiefs, and city managers and mayors, et cetera, to come and testify to our committee when, it doesn't seem to matter? I just don't understand the process, and I'd like to see something. I'd like to see this handled in a different way in the future. And I don't know if you want to respond to that. I guess I would say even, a bigger question is that we specifically spent a lot of money in developing a plan so that this very thing that's happening with this bill would not happen, in that you have regional training centers, and that not every city and town in the state of Minnesota comes into the state and gets bonding requests, and where local property taxes probably should be used, and then it never ends. It never ends. And so maybe that's a two-part question. I don't know how you want to respond to it, but I have to say that this year I think I was more frustrated than in the past when I think our committee's recommendations to you and the committee were just were not even evaluated.
Mr. Chair, yes. Some of the chairs at the table may recall in January when it was clear, well, first of all, we had a very late start. We were starting late February. And then when the deadlines, the committee deadlines were announced, there was going to be a very short period of time between the start of session and committee deadlines. And so I believe in January already I communicated with all of the chairs about that problem. And suggested that if there were going to be hearings, if they could be that last week in January when the speaker called for meetings, and I know Representative Murphy did that. She had her hearing that week. And then I asked to, as much as possible, sit down with chairs, and so I spent significant time with Representative Wagenius. Whether we can hang on to all of her hopes and dreams, I don't know. Certainly had lots of conversation with Representative Pawlowski as well. And so we encouraged chairs to either have hearings that last week in January before session began, or failing that, to just have conversations about what they saw going forward. And so to look at what the agencies were requesting and give us feedback. Partly because of the late start and then the timeline for committee hearings, it took a different direction this year.
Well, I guess that was the explanation.
Okay. Any further discussion? In that case, Representative Houseman renews her motion that House File 1068, the second engrossment as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. Motion carried. Representative Houseman, we now have House File 2490. Would you care to make a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that House File 2490, first engrossment, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration.
Okay, the motion is before us, and I see you have a couple of amendments. I assume you want to take those.
I will move the DE5 amendment, and two. Representative Detmer's point, if you see this spreadsheet, and I'm assuming members all have this, what we first did was that column on the right, the cash, the general fund, and so you had specifically referenced the Veterans Affairs. We don't have any portion of the Veterans Affairs in cash, and so that's why you didn't see anything in that column. Now we're doing the DE5 amendment, and that is now before us. And so, Mr. Chair, again, just because you all have that spreadsheet, I think I won't even bother. We have a busy schedule ahead of us. We could.
Okay, any discussion then on the amendment?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I was referring to the spreadsheet on the GEO column. I know there was no cash for the veterans, but I was I did have my concern about the money that was originally there was around $4.2 million for the Veterans Affairs, and now we're down to 2.5, and we were originally at I think 4.2. For military affairs, now we're down to 3.2. So that was my concern. Yeah. And looking at other monies that are being spent in parks and so forth, I felt that money invested into our veterans facilities would be a good investment.
And Mr. Chair, in my original bill, I fully funded all of their requests. In this amendment, we have now gone, we've had discussions with the governor's office, and with some language changes, we have gone closer to what the governor's numbers were in his bill.
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair, so what I'm hearing is the commander-in-chief has decided to reduce the amount of money for our veterans.
Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, you may recall in last year's very small bill, when we funded nothing else, the capital and flood mitigation, in that very small bill, we had $18 million for Veterans Affairs. That right now is still, they are still waiting. That was to match federal money. And as in a number of other areas, we are still now waiting for that federal match. No federal money has come in yet for that $18 million. So it's still on the, that $18 million, which we approved last year, is still waiting to be matched with the federal, by the federal government.
Representative Denver. Okay, any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? No. Motion carried. Representative Hausman, the A22 amendment.
Mr. Chair, this there were two inadvertent omissions as we moved very quickly with a number of people making suggestions this weekend, and our bill funds a significant number of trails all around the state. Those come right out of the community. All of the work is done on a grassroots level. And many of those trails, as on a number of other projects, those people in those communities have been working for a decade waiting. There have been line item vetoes on trails. There have been years when we didn't fund. I believe the Senate bill only funds one trail. And so we have honored the work of many, many communities by forwarding these. This one, for some reason, in a draft, dropped out, and so we are restoring that. And, of course, as you can see, I take that money from things near and dear to me, from Como and Metro Parks, in order to get that back on the spreadsheet.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Representative Cotton.
This is sort of related to, this is the H-22 amendment?
Yes.
I noticed that we're paving approximately 28.5 miles of the Loose Line Trail. There's one section of the Loose Line Trail that is not paved, and that's the one closest to, it's the one where I've had one of my major bicycle accidents on because it wasn't paved. And could we have some explanation about why that's not getting paved, maybe after we do this amendment?
Representative Hausman.
Is she asking the gentleman to come forward?
I would like to ask whoever is in charge of paving the Loose Line Trail to find out why we're not paving that the only unpaved section of the Loose Line Trail.
And Mr. Chair, while he's coming forward, I have to tell you, this is the trail where there's a local vineyard, and the owner of that local vineyard identified that trail as a significant part of how he would build his business, and he, at his own expense, is going to make build a connection from his business to the Loose Line Trail. So we had a very interesting visit there at that point.
Mr. Chairman, I'm talking about the section that's in Hennepin County. The section is in Hennepin County.
Welcome, and if you could identify yourself.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name's Steve Cook, and I'm the mayor of Hutchinson. Been working with other communities in our county and with the help and partnership of the DNR to do this project. To answer Representative Kahn's question, as part of the Loose Line Trail's master plan, the section of the trail east of this area that we're going to be paving has been identified as an area that would be crushed limestone. So it is following the master plan that was really worked on through community input and over the years. That said, we've had discussions with community leaders in that area, and they're watching our project. And their hope is that as this gets funded, that helps them raise awareness and start the communication of trying to pave sections to the east as well. So this is kind of leading the project. So I hope that helps.
I'd just like to point out that it is a dangerous section, particularly it's different when you're on a trail that's only crushed limestone, you kind of know what kind of bike to take on it and how to ride on it. But you go from a place that starts out paved, becomes crushed limestone, and then becomes paved again. It's asking, I wish there were some. I can't believe I'm the only person who's had a bad accident on that section. I wish there were some statistics that would look at what's happening on, in that. But of this section of having an unpaved section in between two paved sections of what's supposed to be kind of a highway type trail.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and
Mr. Cook.
And again, I appreciate that. The section we're trying to pave now isn't even the crushed limestone, it's just gravel. So it's even more dangerous and really underutilized because of that. When you see different trail maps, they don't even show the trail in this area being a bike trail anymore. So, and that's several different biking maps. So, again, it's a step forward in a lot of areas and then hopefully leads to some of this other work as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. Representative Gunther, I have on my notes, it just says GOP amendment, but I am told that that's your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In both cases, I plead guilty.
In both cases, you plead guilty.
I'm a GOP, and I'm having the amendment.
Yeah, I just was going by my notes. I had to ask who was moving the amendment, and Ms. Conley, who is from Montgomery, by the way.
That's cool.
Many years ago, right?
No, it can't be that many years ago.
Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman and members, this Amendment A14 is about the Lewis and Clark Joint Powers Board. In some parts of the state, we are short of good quality water. The water is so high in nitrates in this area that is bad for babies and young children.
Representative Gunther, maybe we could back up a bit. We need to, one, have you move the amendment, okay. And Ms. Conley reminds me that because this amendment came in late, it wasn't in the packet, so has it been distributed? It has been distributed, okay. So, Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the A14-1205 amendment.
Okay, motion is before us, and has everybody found the amendment then? Okay, Representative Gunther.
As I was saying, this area of the state has very poor quality water, very high in nitrates. It aborts animal fetuses. I think that's the way I put it. And it takes, it's very harmful for babies. It's very harmful for doing the normal things people do with fresh water. And we're very fortunate here in the cities and even where I live to have the Prairie du Chien Aquifer, which is very high quality water. However, they don't have that benefit. They couldn't build another ethanol plant or anything else using a lot of water in Marshall because of these problems. And the governor, in his State of the State speech, very, very highly recommended this project. And we have to have a match for the federal government's input and their money. So we're asking for $69,180,000, and so we can construct a pipeline to deliver water just like they do in our cities, the farm places, so they can do the laundry and everything else that we do. So it's a definite
hardship.
You
might want to speak into your mic.
It's a definite hardship.
Okay, motion is before us. Representative Houseman, advice?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This cuts in its entirety the Bell Museum, Springbrook Nature Center, the Sculpture Garden, and Giants Ridge to fully fund Lewis and Clark. It is true. The governor strongly supports this amount, $69 million, but what he said is, if we have a $1.2 billion bonding bill, he fully supports this. Here's the history of this, and by the way, it is one of many water problems around the state right now, including in the East Metro, where some of you live and where some of you have worked very hard to resolve them. We have not resolved any of them, and at least in part, we have to look at infrastructure and also finally who pays, what's fair to everybody as we have these developing water problems. In the case of Lewis and Clark, this has been on our drawing board a very long time ago. I worked with previous legislators. They brought the first request to us. And our state's share was going to be $5.8 million, and then the federal government was going to do the rest. This is a multi-state project. We very quickly passed the state share a long time ago. And just as with the veterans, we have waited in vain for the federal government to do the rest of it. So what we're being asked to do now is fund the federal government's portion. We did the state's portion a very long time ago. That is unfortunately in transportation, in veterans affairs, in water, whatever. We have done a valiant effort in the state, but the federal government share has not been forthcoming. But let me say just a word about a couple of the projects being removed, because they've been around for a decade as well. Springbrook, when it was first brought to us, Springbrook Nature Center, it was brought in the same year as an East Metro Nature Center. So there was an East Metro Nature Center chaired by Carol McFarland, and there was a West Metro Springbrook. And this was in the Pawlenty administration. The East Metro Nature Center was signed, and the Springbrook one was vetoed. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, the East Metro project is flourishing, and the West Metro project, Springbrook, is waiting. Many, many times they've brought it. It's been the subject of line item vetoes, and that is before us. And now a word about Bell Museum and Planetarium. The chair and I worked together again at least a decade ago on these two projects. The chair was the author, Representative Carlson was the author of the planetarium bill. It was, I think, $22 million. And it was to go on the top floor of the new Minneapolis Library. For a number of years, we hoped that would materialize. As sometimes happens, a city has a hard time figuring out how are we going to make this work, how do we support this. And so at one point, in 4 years, bonding lapses, it can't automatically cancels, and so we extended the time to give them more time. Then you may know that the libraries in Hennepin County and Minneapolis merged, and so that was a second change that we made in another year. The money was no longer going to Minneapolis but to Hennepin County, and so there was another period where Hennepin County had hoped to make that work, and it didn't. So the Bell Museum eventually started conversation with the state's Natural History Museum. State's Natural History Museum established in 1872 by visionary legislators. The legislature established it and said we should gather the state's natural history, we should catalog it, and it's for the future generations to learn about us. Those were visionary legislators in 1872. Since then, legislators have been rather irresponsible in taking care of this treasure. I received a picture last week of the inside of the Bell Museum in that rain and showed how they were draping plastic everywhere to try to protect it. There are dioramas that are nationally known there that are at great risk in this building. And we tried, as I said, for 10 years. This has been also the subject of a line item veto over time. And this project, this is now a merger of the Natural History Museum and the Bell Museum. And at one point when the Bell Museum came to me, they said, we would be better served on the Falcon Heights campus than the other campus because all our collections are, in terms of academic alignment, are better served on that campus where other collections are present. And it would free space on the main campus for the College of Design to relocate to be closer to its academic counterparts. So a very long history. And now suddenly, these organizations that have been serving the state and educating children in the state hear themselves being described as a want, not a need. That has been very hurtful to them. You have all received at your offices, I don't know how much time you have to read them, a description, a lengthy description of the Natural History Museum and Planetarium. But one of the people who's taken up its cause is Paul Douglas, who maybe you remember as a the weather guy on the channel until he formed his own business to study Minnesota weather. And he says the following. I'm a big believer in science education and science literacy. Our kids and grandkids will need to be well-versed in science to succeed and maximize their potential in a very tech-savvy world. We lead the nation in the agricultural science, the arts, medical device technology, and innovation, but the Twin Cities Metro has yet to build a planetarium, and the Bell Museum of Natural History needs an overhaul and upgrade to remain competitive. Moving forward on a bonding request, and then he describes this. But last night was the more challenging response. At 11:09 p.m., a gentleman who is connected to the planetarium was responding to what he had heard yesterday, and that is that his service is a want and not a need. And he says the following about the Minnesota Planetarium Society legacy. First, I'm very proud of what we have built after the planetarium was torn down in 2002. With no state or federal support, we created the Explora Dome, the first portable version of the Hayden Planetarium. We developed an inquiry style of interactive teaching and learning with large data, which continues to be copied by others around the world. We shared our knowledge and built the first interoperable network of teaching planetaria in the world, located across the upper Midwest. Here are the sites around the state. Of course, in Bell Museum, Como Elementary in St. Paul, Jackson Middle School in Champlin, Mankato East High School in Mankato, Mayo High School in Rochester, Minnesota State University in Moorhead, Southwest Minnesota State in Marshall. Those are the partnerships that this planetarium has. And he states, or President Kaler has stated on many occasions, we need to bring university research to bear on closing the achievement gap. Unfortunately, the university for 6 years hung in there on this project, and they have sort of given up and moved on. I cannot give up because of this. Here is how he compares what other areas are doing. While many of us have been advocating for this project for over 10 years, there are some interesting other things going on across the country. North Carolina, I'll cite one. I had the privilege, this is a Museum of Natural Sciences, I had the privilege of helping develop the new North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. This state-funded project went from a dark corner of their state agricultural building in 2000 to becoming the most visited attraction in the state. Earlier this week, they were awarded the 2014 National Medal for Museum and Library Service, the nation's highest honor. North Carolina, state funded. And I think he cites it's an $80 million expansion to their $100 million building. That's what other states are doing in this area. Our lack of vision in this area is quite distressing to me. I'm strongly opposed to the amendment.
Okay, any further discussion? Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a good opportunity for this committee to do the right thing. We've just heard that, you know, some people's feelings are hurt, and I apologize for that, Representative Hausman, that some people's feelings are hurt that their project is considered a want and not a need for $51 million for a Bell Museum. I've heard that now the Bell Museum and the planetarium is going to fix the achievement gap. And I'd like to see the studies that show us that a planetarium is going to fix the achievement gap. I've heard Representative Kahn, and God bless you, I'm sorry that you've had a biking accident. We're going to spend money to pave bike trails so that we don't have those accidents. All potentially good projects. We're going to do a ski chalet. up on Grants Ridge or Giants Ridge. We're going to do a lot of things in this bill, but the one thing we're not going to do if we don't pass this amendment is get water to people who desperately need it. Southeast Minnesota needs this project. And it is great that we're going to find two more theaters, and I see lots of hands being raised, and I'm sure there's going to be lots of defense to these projects, but literally we are funding a palace, the Palace Theater, before we fund water for thirsty southeastern Minnesotans. And I hope that if this amendment does not pass, that we will in the next few days figure this out. This is a matter of priorities. And members, lots of good projects. Everybody wants their own little thing done. I personally have never had a bonding project in my 4 years here because I think there are other needs throughout this state that are more important than needs that some of my district might have because we're going to fund our own projects down there. And I appreciate the fact that there are some areas of this state that does need bonding. And I would support a bonding bill that actually did the things that the rest of the state really needs, including Minneapolis and St. Paul. We are literally funding drainage projects for a sculpture garden before we give water to thirsty southeastern Minnesotans. We need to take a good hard look at this one. And I hope that you will really hear what's happening down there. And the fact is, this area of the state needs this project. And while Minneapolis may need a drainage project for its sculpture garden, I would argue that the need of thirsty southeastern Minnesotans greatly outweighs a drainage project for sculptures. So please take it. Look at this. Dig deep into your hearts and really think through this. This is a good amendment. Thank you, Representative Gunther, for bringing it up. Again, if it doesn't pass this committee, I guarantee this will be a topic of conversation. And I would hate to see all these other good projects not be actually funded in a bonding bill if we can't get really good projects in our funding in this bonding bill. So please vote yes for this one. Let's get this bonding bill through. Let's get the session done. Let's get the things that Minnesotans want us to do done, and this will make that happen. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Dean. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Halsman, I really appreciate your advocacy for the Bell Museum project. I have to admit that I went to school across the street from the Bell Museum on Church Street, so I walked by it every single day, twice a day for 4 years, and I never walked into the Bell Museum until I was on your committee. And I brought my daughter in, and there's a, as you go in, there's a big coyote that's stuffed in these dioramas. And some people think they're a little creepy, but I like the dioramas. The kids like the dioramas. They're very nice. And evidently the money that was given to this one was by a guy, Bob Johnson or something, and there's a little brass plaque that said Bob Johnson and the date that he must have given the money for this or whatever. And my daughter looked at the coyote and looked down at the plaque and looked up at the coyote, and she looked at me and she says, "Is that Bob Johnson?" So that was my introduction to the Bell Museum. Which I like, and as you point out, is an asset. But also, would look at the need to have balance in a bonding bill and in all of our priorities here at the legislature. And we have wants and we have needs and we have things that are, as then Speaker Spigum used to say, things that are nice to have and things you ought to have. And things you need to have, and to have balance within that, within a bonding bill as well. And when the Lewis and Clark project has been kind of coming to the surface this year, it really has, I think, generated a much-needed discussion and an important discussion around priorities and around being able to solve problems for the state of Minnesota and being able to have balance. People scratch their heads when they say that you can't fund this at all, but you can fund all of museums or all of planetariums and other projects. And we've had 3 years of agreeing to nothing or agreeing to everything. And I think that it's kind of coming to a head. And I think that this is a very important decision for this particular amendment. To fund the the Lewis and Clark Trail at zero when we have new federal funding, from what I understand from Senator Franken, working very diligently and hard to try to capture some federal dollars to put that in immediately, and I appreciate his work on that. $20 million, from what I understand, would be able to get this project to Laverne, and the additional $7 million would be able to get it to the Rock County distribution point, where that water could be fed to other places, and this is from the South Dakota border. And if you've been down in that area, you understand that it's much more like the Dakotas than it is like eastern Minnesota or where I live. It's a very different part of the state, and it has very, very specific needs. And those needs for not just growth, but being able to carry on the businesses and life in these small towns requires water, and it requires it right now. Our biggest priority should be disaster relief and emergency relief with bonding bills. The next one should be basic water, sewer, and infrastructure needs. Next would be transportation, in my opinion. But I think we also need amenities and cultural amenities. We understand that that's important, too, and to have a balance and also to have a geographic balance. This points out the need to have a little balance within the bill. I also would point out that the University of Minnesota has not ranked this project on their rankings, and we all look to the university that does a great job of looking at their needs and telling us what their needs are in assessments of that. So as much as I appreciate the projects that are on this list, they're all good projects, I think we need this water more in southern Minnesota. I think they're bone dry and parched, and I think if we don't do this, it sends a really bad message to the folks in southwest Minnesota, and also sends a message to the folks in Minnesota that we really can't solve problems and compromise and get along and move forward. So I would strongly encourage a vote, and thank Representative Gunther for bringing forward this amendment. I would ask for a roll call.
A roll call has been requested. Representative Wagenius.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Woodward, and Representative Dean. I look forward to the discussion on the floor about water in this state, particularly since in that same southwest part of the state, the city of Marshall is building a pipeline at its own expense, 27 miles to get water. The city of Park Rapids is building a new drinking water treatment system at its own expense because there's nitrogen in the water. They didn't put it there, but they're building it at their expense to get rid of the nitrogen. The prices of the drinking water in that area are going to go up 25%. City of St. Peter just built a new drinking water system at a huge cost. I think it was about $17 million, but before we get to the floor, I'll make sure I have that number. So the question is, here, if we are going to do water for one part of the state, do we do drinking water for the rest of the state? And I hope you guys know the numbers if we do that, because the issues are all over the state, including Representative Dean's area, where it is becoming quite apparent that we need a new drinking water system on the Mississippi River. But the folks don't want to pay for it. They want us to pay for it. So let's have these discussions. I think it's a good one for us to have. But in the meanwhile, I think until we get to the fairness issue, this is a no vote.
Representative Biernet? Or Brainerd? Excuse me. No. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Representative Wagenius, the difference between the Marshall Project and some of those that you mentioned, Marshall is a fairly large city with some very good, big, generous employers. We're talking about rural water. We're talking about individual farmers. We're talking about very small towns. They cannot have the resources that Marshall has. That's the big difference. If they could afford to do it themselves, I'm sure they would have done a long time ago. But they don't have the resources that we have in the metro area or in the larger cities in greater Minnesota. So there's a big difference. They can't afford, they have to have water. We have two other water projects, rural water projects in Minnesota. And I know St. James, the community I used to have in my district, is putting in 5 million gallons a day into the Red Rock water. So it's a concerted effort from all southern Minnesota. But we need to have water for people to live, and they don't have the resources that Marshall has.
Any Representative Hausman?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just a final note. First of all, I should say we probably, a number of us probably have stories of children and grandchildren in the Bell Museum. Mine is that I signed my 7-year-old grandson up for a Bell camp last summer, and he's fairly practiced in a broad range. He pronounced it the best camp he'd ever been to, and so I signed him up for 2 this year. So I want to just put this in the context of our discussion this year. Really, members, this shouldn't be an either-or. This shouldn't be an either-or. We should be able to do water projects and disaster relief and roads and bridges and arts and culture and museums and trails. And here is why. I contend that if we talk about infrastructure as though it is only disaster relief and roads and bridges, we have a narrow view of what creates a healthy state. What I didn't bring today is all of the information I brought last year and read to everybody about the economic impact of all of these things that we sometimes describe as wants, not needs, sometimes as unnecessary amenities. Even in greater Minnesota towns, they are reshaping their economy. As they move away from the family farm, which used to shape those small towns, as they move away from Main Street businesses because they're displaced by big box stores, all of those cities, everywhere across the state, are rethinking, how do they build a healthy economy? How do they keep people there? How do they draw people there? And there, as in the metro area, they're reshaping it around arts and culture, parks and trails, museums. The statistics about the economic impact of all of those things is substantial. Just in arts and culture, a few years ago I used the term $1 billion a year contribution. So whether you're in Chatfield or Grand Rapids or St. Paul, that commitment to arts and culture, museums, all of those things that we want to dismiss as unnecessary, as nice to have become part of who we are, part of what draws Fortune 500 companies here to the quality of life in the state. So it is not an either or. We should in this state be able to do both, but for whatever reason, we are thinking small when it comes to infrastructure. So members, I would encourage a no vote on this.
You know, just a comment. I happen to serve on the Capital Investment Committee, and we spent literally 20 days, if I recall correctly, on the road looking at the infrastructure needs across the state of Minnesota. And I think what we're seeing with this amendment, with Representative Detmer's comments earlier about a greater need, is that, you know, the reality, we need 81 votes, and the other reality is that there are those in the legislature that will not vote for a bonding bill that goes above $846 million. Even though if you follow what's being said across the state of Minnesota and the media and everything, they're saying this is a target of opportunity that we're missing. Interest rates are very low. And this whole discussion, I think, has been healthy in the sense that it does show that that constraint that many of us are concerned about, that we have to live with because of the need for 81 votes, is going to leave us lacking in terms of what many of the needs are. Now, we can debate specific projects, but I think personally the bottom line is the problem with an 846 number. We had, I think, about $2.7 billion in requests when we went across the state. Not saying that under any circumstance we could meet the $2.7 billion, but this would be a target of opportunity that we're missing to at least move more in the direction of supporting the state's infrastructure a little bit better than what those constraints that we've been having to live under because of the need for the 81 votes and the reluctance on the part of some to go above 846. But with that,
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kyle.
As we have this conversation, I think we should never stop not mention that by not passing a bonding bill last year, we lost $50 million because the interest rates were at a historic low. Then they were only destined to go higher, which they did, and they're now destined to go even higher if we miss this bonding year. And that $50 million would have covered, well, the Bell Museum and I guess a good part of the Lewis and Clark project.
Because the interest rates were lower. They're a little higher this year. They're still low. They'll probably be higher again next year, and you make a very good point, Representative Cunn. Okay, with that, roll call has been requested. Clerk will take the roll.
Carlson?
No.
Abler?
Yes.
Anderson?
No. Or yes.
Amzel?
No.
Atkins?
No.
Beard?
Aye.
Reinhart?
No.
Clark?
No.
Davis excused, Dabney excused, Dean?
Yep.
Detmer?
Yes.
Gunther?
Yes.
Hackbarth?
Yes.
Hoseman?
No.
Hillstrom?
No.
Holberg excused, Hornstein?
No.
Huntley?
No.
Kahn?
No.
Manchesky excused, Loon?
Yes.
Mahoney?
No.
Mariani?
No.
Marquardt?
No.
McNamara?
Yes.
Mullery?
No.
Norris?
Yes.
Paymar?
No.
Polowski?
No.
Poppy?
No.
Simon?
No.
Wagenius?
No.
Woodard?
Yes.
Okay, being 11 ayes and 18 nays, the motion does not prevail. Representative Houseman renews her motion that House File 2490, the first engrossment as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration. Any further discussion? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Houseman, for the work and the staff in putting this together. I'm just wondering if anyone from MMB would happen to be here to discuss the overall debt capacity and our limit on the spending, since this is the capital investment bill in Ways and Means, if anyone would happen to be here.
There does seem to be someone here, and she's coming forward, so she's behind you.
Thank you. And as Ms. Zures comes down, I thank you, Ms. Zures, and sorry for not giving you the heads up on this.
If you could identify yourself for the record, and then if you could read or state your question, restate it.
Mr. Chair and members, Corinne Zewers from Minnesota Management and Budget.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Zewers. Could you talk about one of the things that we always look at is how much money we can borrow when we're looking at GO bonding in our basically our credit card limit. The debt capacity limit by our new guidelines in guideline one is 3.25% of income within the state as the amount of money that we should borrow without going over that debt guideline limit number one. Could you tell us what that debt guideline limit is currently under one with the latest revenue projections from the state?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, under guideline one, the as a percent of state personal income, we are at 2.44% as of the February forecast.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Roos. One of the things that I requested from the department, actually one of the things that we have under statute is MMB is supposed to give us kind of a report on how much money we can borrow without hitting our head on the debt limit. If we were to max out that to go to the 3.25 from where you are, can you just give us an idea of how much money we would, what would our bottom line be if we were to max out that credit card under guideline one?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, just looking at the February forecast, and then are you, just one point of a clarifying question, are you looking into the future or just the point in time which is included in the February forecast?
Representative Dean. I guess, Ms. Zuers, what we would look for is just if we were to receive a report based on the forecast, what that would be and what would our capacity be or what would our spending limit be?
Ms. Zuers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, the limit based on the February forecast under Guideline 1 would be between $700 and $800 million. One of the points of clarification with that, though, is that that is based on authorized and issued debt, and when MMB issues debt and actually prepares our forecast, only a small percentage of the debt is actually issued in the first year. So that guideline does not indicate that only a $700 to $800 million bill could be passed this year if you were staying within the guidelines, but rather that that's the amount of debt that we could actually that we could sell, the amount of bonds that we could sell. When looking out into the future and actually projecting, and some of our, I would say that these are very long-term projections, they are, we're looking at about $1.3 billion in bonds.
Thank you, Ms. Sewers. And Mr. Chair, the point is, I think, that with our debt capacity guidelines that were restructured under the Pawlenty administration to look at how much money we can borrow. Currently, if we had our credit card statement, it would say that we're spending too much money within the current amount of money at $850 is over our debt limit. We can kind of look at that and say spread it out over time based on current projections. But I think that that's an important point to be made because it's always an important thing that we look at in terms of what our debt capacity is and trying to limit the amount of money that we're borrowing. So you say, well, why is it important to stay within the agreement? Number one, I think when people shake hands around here and make an agreement, that should be honored, that it shouldn't be rescinded. If you make an agreement on Monday, on Tuesday, I think that agreement should hold, that's how this the institution needs to work, and I think Minnesotans expect us to be able to make agreements and move forward. And number two, I think we ought to be able to live within a budget, particularly if it's a budget that we have agreed upon as a borrowing limit of 3.25% of assets. We look at our forecast. We use forecasts to set our budgets in all of our agencies and in all of our committees. So I think that is an important point to make as well, that when we say, well, we ought to just set aside the agreement we made, whether it was an agreement or not, we can set that aside and we can break those agreements and not honor them. And if we do have a limit that that we've imposed upon ourselves, if not by the bonding agencies, of a cap of 3.25%, we ought to not just disregard that as well. So I want to make those two points as we move forward. But also, I think this is a case where the bill is going, heading to the floor through rules, and we obviously would like this to pass. We need this to pass very quickly. I would like this to get something that could get broad support, not just 8 Republicans, but indeed many Republicans to vote for it. I think that that's part of our job, but we see kind of the bill and the Democrats going in one direction and kind of reality kind of going in another direction. And I think that's a problem as we're heading to the floor to get this done. We have very little time on our hands, but I just want to pledge our support for the committee's work and also extend the our offer, a sincere offer to negotiate and to try to come to something that is not everything or nothing, but something for everyone in the state of Minnesota in very short order. So I just want to put that on the record as well as thank Chair Hausman and all of the committee staff and the people on the Capital Investment Committee that put in a lot of time, including you, Mr. Chair, who had perfect attendance on all of the trips. And very punctual.
Probably why I was number one in the newspaper for per diem reimbursement, but way behind the Senate. You know, just a quick comment because I was the one that brought up the that there were members of the legislature. I didn't identify what members, but we are working within that constraint, that 846. That's what the billion or the bill is about. But that doesn't mean that you can't have a reasonable discussion about how that is not meeting the needs, unfortunately. But I would point out that there is a difference, as was pointed out by Mazur's from MMB, between what is authorized in a given bill and what is actually issued. I've had the opportunity with Representative Hausman and others. We've sat in on the sales of the bonds and so on. And all of that is carefully staged by MMB. So when we pass a bill authorizing a certain level, you really have to have that discussion then about the future and when those bonds would actually be issued as various construction projects go online. And that's monitored very carefully. So, you know, yes, you could argue, and this is sometimes the difficulty with numbers, that as was pointed out, it would be 700 or 800 million, but if you talk about the future and the staging of those sales and so on, then the number that was used was 1.3 billion. There have been some discussions of 1.2, which would still be below that. And they've only been discussions in terms of when we talked about in Representative Hausman's committee what the requests are and what the needs of the infrastructure are across the state of Minnesota. But I've said enough at this point, Representative Hausman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it is important to say for the public record that the language we use is important. And when we use phrases like max out our credit card or talk about debt limit or cap, it suggests a tighter constraint than it is in reality. What we have are guidelines for debt capacity. They're not in law intentionally. They are guidelines that we use. And here is the assessment of Moody's, Fitch, Standard & Poor's. I wish I had brought their reports, but I'll summarize. They, frankly, I have to tell you, don't care at all how big our bonding bill is. Here's what they say about us. When they determine what our credit rating is, they look at our state and they say, you aren't dependent on one industry. You have a diverse economy. In a state like North Dakota, when that industry goes belly up, they're going to have problems. If we were dependent on one industry, it would be a problem. But they credit us with a diverse economy. They further say we have a healthy and improving economy. And they look at how we're balancing our budget. And they weren't very happy with us those few years when we were doing the tobacco securitization bond, when we were borrowing one time to balance the budget. That they didn't like. They didn't like when we shifted. They didn't like that, and they made mention of it. But now they make mention of the opposite, that we are honestly balancing our budget. We're repaying our shifts. They say that in their reports, that we have turned around these bad habits. And then they point out we're also restoring a cash reserve. Between cash flow and cash reserve, we now have over $1 billion, and that's going to continue. So diverse economy, healthy and improving economy. And then they further say we have a low to moderate debt level compared to other states. And if you read all three of their reports, it is consistent. They all view our state in the same way. And so lest we think Minnesota is irresponsible, all you have to do is read those three reports to get a different point of view. I just think it's very important to say for the record that compared to other states, and I think in your recent Tax Foundation book, yet again, we're ranked among all the states number 37 in terms of debt to, per capita or something.
Okay, Representative Abler, and then I think we have another bill up, so I think after Representative Abler, unless there's another pressing question or comment, we'll take our vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to comment more about just the general economic parts of the state and the and which the bill is a part of, and the sustainability and what's going to happen in the future. I will not be at this table next year, Mr. Chair. I'm hoping to be at a different table. But those who remain here who are charged with watching the welfare of our economic status are likely to be many of the same members here. And you got to be prudent as you go forward. And so as we looked at the $6 billion deficit that occurred in 2011, which was from a lot of reasons, and how we got out of that, and some of the things that were put into place have been actually a little unrolled. Some of the healthcare spending that's occurred in this biennium have been largely very, very much increases in terms of relying on the federal government to come through with borrowed money. The tails are in excess of $5 billion a biennium, which is higher than ever before. The previous record was $3 billion all funds in a biennium. Another time it was a billion, and it was lean times, but we managed, we economized, we reformed. And simply just adding money that you hope you can have in the future is risky. And so one good thing about the crisis of 2011 was that we provoked a lot of reform. And Minnesota's healthcare system got even better. And it got more lean, it got more focused. Some services, in fact, improved to the clients who were dependent upon our care as we moved people into better settings and did a lot of work about that. That has not continued in this biennium, Mr. Chair. And instead, we spent some money in health care, and we expanded Medicaid, a system that's barely tenable. But we're on the hook for that. And the state share of that part of the budget is going to be increasing over time. And it's a burden you'll have to bear in Minnesota. And I wanted to caution you that the last 2 months of economic forecast receipts were below projection. And so if you spend everything, lucky you're putting some into the reserve, but if you spend everything, you put yourself at risk for being able to sustain the very programs you care so much about. And Chair Houseman, you've got a heart of gold, and I appreciate the arts, and I appreciate the safety features. I appreciate water in the rural parts of the state, which have no greater Minnesota, which have no means to bear their own. And you have a very difficult job. But to the members, if you add up the two parts, it's $1.046 billion, which is a fair amount of money. And there's a lot of needs. When we were in a human service world, we had to make some hard choices, very hard choices, about what to buy, what not to buy, who to serve, and how to serve them better. But I just want to caution you, Mr. Chair, and the members, as we go forward, we should be celebrating the fact that we have $1 billion to spend on some very worthy projects. There's competition. Certainly there's a process to go forward where both policy and politics will reign. But at the end, the people in Minnesota count on us to make sure these things can be paid for. And they don't want a deficit time again. And it was the opinion of the majority that if we raise taxes $2 billion on individuals and businesses and families, that would be a way to buy our way out of this. Some of us were concerned about that, and we're fearful of the elasticity that would be provoked, where there would be actually less activities going forward. We heard from revenue people that they did not, and the budget folks, that they didn't have a lot of factoring in that elasticity as we talked about the budget forecast. And so I'm just cautioning you as a departing member that the very number you have at your hands may be even untenable. And so you don't want to overspend your budget. You don't want to have to go back to your credit cards. You don't want to be maxing everything out to the highest amount possible, but you want to be frugal and reasonable. And in the areas you think are so important, if you apply the metrics that I used in the human service world of essential, important, and nice, That still leaves room for the arts, still leaves room for the water, still leaves room for some amenities that make a Minnesota great. You have to draw business, but you got to be prudent about this. And so I just wanted to tell you that, because I think in the context of we can't go to the $1.2 billion or something, you think, oh, then all is lost. But I think as we move forward in a good way, and I think between Chair Hausman and Representative Dean and others working on this, they're going to come up with a really good bill that hopefully can generate a dozen or 20 votes on my side. I'm hoping to support it. But I just wanted to point out the big picture. Because what I've noticed in my time here, 16 years, which doesn't seem possible, is that we lose the big picture. We focus on the minutia, our own little area, the public safety, healthcare, arts, whatever, without noticing the great grand scheme of things. And not to lecture you, but just to point out in a kind way how we govern well. And I know every member in this room cares about that. I just called upon you to remember that, and thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Abel, I don't view it as lecturing. I don't view any of the discussion as lecturing. I think it was a healthy discussion, is the way I would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would put it in from folks on both sides of the aisle. Representative Hausman, a concluding comment, and then we'll vote, or you're all set. Okay, Representative Hausman renews her motion that House File 2490, the first engrossment as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
Thank
well,
you.
Thank you, Representative Hausman, and not for just this morning, but when we reference those 20 days on the road, all of your hard work that's gone into the bill.
Thank you, members.
We now will move to the next bill on the agenda. Maybe we'll wait a quick second for the room to clear.
That was longer than I thought.
With a drink?
Certain bike trails.
No, no, no.
Very
no.
Dangerous.
Excuse me?
Certain bike trails are very dangerous.
I didn't hear that.
Got a lot of still.
We're dealing with snowmobiles. They can be dangerous.
Hi.
I was going to live there in the first place.
Am I going to testify?
Yeah, I'm going to get out of here now.
I'm just going to bell. What is this?
Okay, if I think the room is mainly clear to those that were interested in the first bill, I think a few of you maybe are having some side conversations in the audience that were part of the first bill, so maybe you could take those out into the hallway so we can begin to move forward. Representative Moline has Senate File 2470, which was referred to us from the Rules Committee. Just a quick comment. The whole issue of medical marijuana began in the Health and Human Services Committee initially. There was another bill, a Senate file, that was taken up in the Rules Committee, and the bill was amended there. And the bill is now before us, and there will be some additional amendments. But to get the bill before us, I move that Senate File 2470, the first unofficial engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the General Register. And Representative Moline, I assume then that we'll just take up these amendments to get the bill into the form that you'd like to present it here this morning. So the Chair will move the S2470DL2 amendment, and then you, I understand, have an oral amendment that you'd like to include. So the Chair will move the oral amendment, which is technical, but if you could explain, or maybe Mr. Sullivan can explain where we are with the oral amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, the oral amendment just corrects the introductory line in the amendment to note that it's an amendment to the first unofficial engrossment because it's a Senate file. So the oral amendment's on page 1, line 1, strike third, and insert first unofficial.
Okay, any discussion on that? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion carried. Rep. Simoline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And did you want me to speak to the DE2 before we move to the A81?
Probably good just so people know what it is.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Senate file 2470 and the DE2 that we're on now is the medical cannabis therapeutic research study. The DE2 sort of changes the model from the bill as it is right now, which was more of a clinical trials model into more of a observational research model. The qualifying conditions remain the same. The, you know, overall intent and hopefully outcome remain pretty much the same as what the bill is. It's just that after speaking with the medical community and the Department of Health, it came to our attention that the original language, although we were calling it a clinical trial, was essentially more observational research anyway. So we conformed the language to reflect what our intent was, and that's essentially what the DE2 does.
Okay, any discussion on the DE2 amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. We now have the S2470A8-1 amendment. This one is technical as well. And then there's also an oral amendment with that one. Is that Mr. Marks?
Mr. Chair, members, in the 8-1 amendment on page 5, line 3, the appropriation for the Legislative Coordinating Commission should be $24,000 instead of $21,000, so that if you change the 21 to 24, the budget resolution was set to accommodate 24, and that's the fiscal note as well.
Okay, so any discussion on the oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. We now have the A8-1 amendment before us as amended. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carried. Rep. Simoline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And the A8 amendment that we just adopted is primarily technical. There were a couple of more substantive measures in there, one of them being on page 3, line 24, where we require that the manufacturers who apply to be registered with the Department of Health pay a registration fee of $20,000 in order to submit their application. Manufacturers aren't chosen, have that $19,000 refunded by the department, but we did insert an application fee for manufacturers. On page 4, line 29, we provided language so that if the Department of Health needs more time to meet some of the deadlines in the bill, that they're able to submit that request to the task force that I'll get to, and that task force shall allow them more time in order to comply with the legislation. And the line 2.8 on the A81 amendment clarifies that the manufacturer needs to have a licensed pharmacist, at least one licensed pharmacist employed there to determine dosages for patients. And line 2.22 on the amendment allows delivery fees to be assessed for patients who are unable to pick up the medication for themselves. Line 4.8 on the amendment clarifies some language that Mr. Marks was just talking about regarding the expenses provided for the task force. So other than those changes in the 8.1 amendment, they were primarily technical changes. But we're here to talk about the fiscal cost of the bill that you have in front of you. And if you'll take a look at the fiscal note, it's primarily regarding the cost that the Department of Health will incur. So the way that the bill is set up is a patient registry model. So patients, practitioners, certify that they have a qualifying medical condition and that they therefore qualify for a patient registry to have access to medical cannabis. The qualifying medical conditions in the bill means a diagnosis of cancer, glaucoma, HIV or AIDS, Tourette's, ALS, seizures, including those with the characteristic of epilepsy, severe and persistent muscle spasms such as MS, Crohn's disease, or any other medical condition or its treatment approved by the commissioner. And if a patient has one of those qualifying conditions, they are able to qualify for the patient registry with the Department of Health, and then the department has some oversight requirements as far as licensing and regulating a manufacturer, as well as some reporting requirements that the patient's practitioner has to do back to the Department of Health in order to report how the patient is responding to the treatment so that they are able to gather that research to determine the efficacy of the medical cannabis. And because of those costs, the department is estimating the need for 9.5 FTEs, which are found on page 8 of the fiscal note, and it also clarifies what FTEs they would need in order to administer this program. So those are primarily the costs associated with the bill. There's also a patient registry fee of $200 annually, but if a patient qualifies for disability or Minnesota Care or MA, then their patient fee is $50. And then again, the application fee for the manufacturer. So I'd be happy to answer any questions on the fiscal note, or if Mr. Marks wants to add anything.
Okay, I think you covered that well. Any discussion on the bill? Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, I have a fair number of questions. And just I'll maybe ask a couple, and then I'll ask the Department of Health to come down after other people have had questions. So that might be a good way to respect the time. So just to the bill as it's, did we adopt the amendment? So we're all, is the bill in? Okay. Yes, Emmeline, I appreciate what you've done on this project, and you know I did not support the earlier version and with concerns about Gateway and all that and the effect on the youth and chemical dependency, and I appreciate that you've been able to do some pretty good gymnastics on this and to focus on some of the just the more compelling, the most compelling needs of some of the just the most, you know, just heartrending cases and where there's some good help available to some of these families. I do have some questions specifically on line 1.22 of your delete all and 2.33, it uses the phrase any other. Could you please expand on the author's intent on any other and why you need that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler. We provided that language where the commissioner can't, as you can see, can't approve the smoking of marijuana, but they can approve another method. And I think that, you know, I was trying to get at the point where technology is always changing. You know, we come out with things like the patch where medication can be distributed to a patient that way. So we wanted to allow the commissioner to have a little flexibility in, you know, down the road if we discover that there's a better way to administer medication to these patients. We do provide language, and I will see if I can find it here, where we sort of essentially try to set it up like a sentencing guidelines model, where if the commissioner determines that he or she is going to approve another method of delivery, they have to notify legislative chairs of certain committees, and then the legislature has an opportunity to act to either stop that method of approval, or if they don't act, then it goes forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Reiner.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I still have if I can continue with a few questions. All right, and so there wouldn't be rulemaking then, would it, Representative Molina? It'd just be a letter from the commissioner saying we're going to do a patch or something.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, for that portion of the bill where the commissioner has the opportunity to provide another method of delivery, that would be the model that I just described. We do also have language in the bill that if something comes up that we don't foresee when we pass legislation like this, then there's an expedited rulemaking process available to the commissioner.
Okay.
And that would be, you know, rules, you know, surrounding the manufacturer, or, like I said, something that maybe is just unforeseen.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And then to page 2, where on the conditions, I'm grateful you actually had a limited list, and it seems to me the weakness of the medical marijuana in other states, this is medical cannabis, I guess, given that it's tinctures and extracts, has been in the just the very broad categories of who gets it. And pretty much if you just have a sore elbow almost, you in some states you could pretty well get it, which I saw as a real weakness. And so can you discuss how you see that expanding and the line 2.33 that if I have any uncomfort with the bill, which I actually plan to support today, it's that kind of latitude. And I know our current commissioner would be pretty restrictive in that, but, you know, if Representative Rukabina would, for instance, become the health commissioner, that would be an interesting thought. So just to, if you can just give me some comfort, Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I think that these are the conditions that have been, you know, 21 states have medical marijuana, so we do have sort of observational research coming out of those states, although I think this is a stronger model. There's reporting requirement and data gathered by the department. But, you know, being that we have 21 states with medical marijuana and some of them have had it for well over a decade, and we also have medical research coming out of other countries, and these are the conditions that have been shown to respond well to that treatment, which is why they're outlined in the bill. One example I use for why I think it's important to have the flexibility to allow the commissioner to add another condition is we've seen a lot of testimony this session from kids that suffer from seizure disorders. Back in 2009, when a medical marijuana bill passed and was vetoed at that time, even in 2009, we were unaware that children responded so well to treatment for seizure disorders from medical cannabis. And so it wouldn't have allowed the flexibility to add conditions such as that that we didn't know at the time responded to that unless the commissioner had that sort of ability. So, you know, I think allowing for that flexibility, especially as they gather more research and studies, that, you know, down the road if we discover there's another condition that responds well, the commissioner has the ability to add that condition.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'll do one more question, then I'll ask the Department of Health to come down. On line 2.33, again, the way it's phrased, it says any other medical condition or its treatment approved by the commissioner. Do you have to have the phrase or its treatment? Because that to me seems just unclear. And can you tell me why it was drafted that way? And maybe you'd maybe just mean any other condition. And so you can, do you have an answer or do you want to think about that?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I guess I don't have a real clear answer at this time of why the or its treatment would need to be approved.
Yeah. Because, Mr. Chair, just to, and maybe this is some work for the floor, because you already cover, Representative Moline, you already cover on the first page any methods that you need short of smoking. And I think that treatment on line 233 might refer to kind of methods, so you maybe don't need that. That would just make it clear what you're intending and just allay my concerns. So.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, first of all, I want to thank you for all the work you've done this weekend, especially on the issue around the clinical trials language and the legislation last Friday, and moving to the more the patient registry and the observational research model. I think that's a really strong move for this bill. But I'm very interested in more information about the research and how it might proceed beyond the collecting of data, and maybe you can give me more information on that, or maybe the department is the right body to answer. But
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Brainerd. I think the department would probably be able to answer that better, and it sounds like Representative Adler is going to want to hear from them as well.
Do you want them to come down now, or did you want to delay or wait until they're down with? We can have them come down now.
That's up to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank why you. Don't we take care of the question now? Is the spokesperson for the department present?
I would say, Mr. Chair, Representative Brainerd, if you look on page 8, lines 8.1 to 8.30, it sort of goes through what the requirements are of the healthcare practitioner as far as reporting to the Department of Health on some of the efficacy of the medication and how patients are responding, and then I'll let the department explain what they would do with that data.
Okay, if you could identify yourself for the record, and did you hear the question?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm Ed Ellinger, the Commissioner of Health. And in reflection on what we will do with these data, we're trying to put together an observational study where we can follow the patients and to see what kind of impact they've had with this treatment, if they have any side effects, if they drop out of the program, try to find some way in an observational way without doing a clinical trial to try to get some data from this program that will allow us to enhance the program or make changes in the program as we move forward.
There's a Brenner.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, and maybe you can't answer this yet. I mean, this has been moving very quickly, but I'm curious about how the department will put in place the mechanisms, either in partnership with the medical community or the research community in the state or through its own structure, the mechanisms to do the data analysis once, because there'll be quite a wealth of data coming into the department. And I think the value of this bill is that we're going to do something with that data. So I'm curious about that and how it might look.
Mr. Ellinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are in consultation with the University of Minnesota and with Mayo Clinic and looking through the research on how to do observational studies for medical marijuana. We are trying to set up the monitoring systems. We will be looking at the databases and the IT infrastructure that will be needed to collect that information. And we're looking at the best practices from the university researchers and from Mayo Clinic researchers on putting this together. The detail, as you mentioned, this is a big undertaking. It's a thing that we've not done in quite the same way before, so we really want to do it well, and we are getting some consultation with that.
Okay, Representative Kamar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, I also want to applaud you for continuing to work out some of the bugs of your original bill, and two of the problems that I saw with the original bill, it seems to be remedied under the DE2, which the first one was the requirement that patients had to go to their healthcare practitioner to get their medicine and have the medicine done in that facility, which I think would have been a difficult thing for patients to do and unnecessary. The second one had to do with the mandatory clinical trials that we've already discussed, and I think this is a much better approach. But the third problem that I continue to have is this: the dispensaries, that we're only going to have one facility in the whole state of Minnesota for patients to get their medicines. And I know that law enforcement had concerns about, I think it was 55 that you had in the original bill, but part of the problem with having a bill rushed through the process like this is it doesn't get vetted into the proper committees, which we're having a hearing tonight at 5:30, I believe, a joint informational hearing of the Public Safety Committee and the Civil Law Committee, but the bill will be voted on here, so I don't think we'll be able to vote on any amendments at that hearing, but at the same time it will allow us to propose amendments for the House floor. So this being the fiscal committee, I'm wondering if there is a way to even extrapolate what the cost might be if we expanded the amount of dispensaries to at least to fit the judicial districts in the state of Minnesota, so that people did not have to travel so far to get their medicine. I mean, if you're going to do it in the metro, I suppose you could say, well, most people live in the metropolitan area, so it's not such a hardship, but this is a big state. So I don't even know if that's possible to even guesstimate what it would cost if we expanded to the I think Representative Kahn actually came up with the word sort of satellite dispensaries that the manufacturer would have authority over to make sure that all of the security issues that the law enforcement community was raising were met. So in other words, that there would be 10 of them throughout the state. Still wouldn't make it easy for some people, but you know, much less of an obstacle is coming down to St. Paul to get your medicine once a month. So I don't know, do you have an idea? Is that practical? Is it possible? Is this something we can have an answer to by the hearing this evening?
Rep. Timmeline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Paymire. I can certainly work on getting a better answer by this evening. Obviously, I, being a Greater Minnesota member myself, have concerns with limiting it to one manufacturer and you know, the burden and responsibility that puts on patients. As far as the cost impact would go, I think it's hard to say exactly. I think, you know, we did add the application fee that manufacturers are going to have to submit to the Department of Health. So if, you know, we were to increase the number of manufacturers, then they would all, you know, be subject to pay that application fee as well. We also inserted into the bill an ongoing maintenance fund so that the manufacturer, for the costs associated with the department having to regulate them, basically has to, you know, pay the department for the costs associated with that regulation. So I'm not sure there would really be a fiscal impact if the language changed in that regard. Of course, limiting it to one manufacturer was part of, you know, the big compromise and negotiation with public safety concerns and moving forward. So that's why it went down to one manufacturer. But, you know, I guess I can't speak exactly on what the costs associated would be if any others were added.
Mr. Chair, but what if maybe I didn't, maybe you said it and I didn't understand it. What if the manufacturer had satellite dispensaries around the state that they were responsible for? I'm assuming whether this is a profit manufacturer, for-profit manufacturer, or a nonprofit, that there's going to be a significant amount of revenue from producing medical marijuana. I mean, it seems like it would pay for itself, depending on. So I'm just trying to get, since we're trying to work through the dollars here, if that is an alternative that you discussed or considered with your negotiations with the law enforcement community.
Timeline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, you know, I guess if we were just going to a model where there would be a couple satellite locations in other parts of the state, I don't think that would probably increase cost at all, because the manufacturer is required to pay into that ongoing maintenance fee. So for the Department of Health inspections and regulations. So I'm not sure that satellite locations would increase the cost at all to the state, but of course I'd have to revisit that issue in light of the fact that, you know, this is a compromised approach to limiting significantly where people can access the medical marijuana. So I can't give you an answer on whether or not that would be a possibility. I can only say that I don't think it would probably increase cost to the department to have a couple other locations.
Mr. Chair, you know, again, this is the problem with, you know, coming just to this committee, which we shouldn't even be, I guess, talking about policy. But I, you know, not being able to have these negotiations and ask these questions of the appropriate people at the right committees makes this difficult. So will you be able to get an answer to that, do you think, by this evening's hearing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, I imagine since this evening's hearing is a joint informational hearing between civil law and public safety that the stakeholders in the public safety aspect of the bill will probably be there. So I will try to touch base with them before the hearing, but my guess would be that they will be at the hearing and be able to answer your questions better than I.
Very good.
Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess my questions, which are two, flow off of what Chairman Paymar talked about. First off is, you know, just economics 101. If you have a single source and no competition, that drives prices up. And my question for Representative Moline, have you thought through in terms of how that, what I'm concerned about, you've got some folks behind me here who I think are going to be buying some of these products. What sort of price controls are you going to have in place if there's only a single source?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. That, too, is a concern that I have. I can say that the manufacturers that have taken a look at this language and I've spoken with and the Department of Health has spoken with happen to be nonprofits. So in that sense, I think some of the issues are addressed or at least concerns alleviated, although, you know, there's nothing in the bill that requires the manufacturer to be a nonprofit. I've also been in discussions with the Department of Health to possibly add a provision dealing with price gouging to make sure that the patients are not being taken advantage of in light of the fact that there is one manufacturer.
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Moline, thank you. I know, and by the way, I applaud your yeoman efforts that you have put into this all session long, and I appreciate it. And I see heads nodding around the table who share that. At this point now, I think we're talking about just making sure that we capture some of those things that before it gets too far along. But there are nonprofits in Minnesota that literally make hundreds of millions of dollars a year and pay their CEOs multiple millions of dollars each year. Right now, we have a prescription for profit-taking by having a single source with no competition driving higher prices. So I think you're right on the mark in terms of putting some provision in there to prevent price gouging or some regulatory feature, just like we do with a power company, for example, that, you know, I only get to pay Xcel or buy my product electricity from Xcel. So there's capacity or caps that are placed upon that to prevent that sort of price gouging from occurring. My second question is, my understanding is that other states tax medical marijuana or the sales of marijuana. There is no tax that's proposed in your bill. Is that correct?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, no, there is no tax on the medical marijuana. The patients are required to pay an annual fee to the Department of Health. again, $200 for a patient unless the patient qualifies for disability or MA or Minnesota Care, in which their fee is $50. But other than that, there's no taxing provision.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, just a point on with respect to that is to the extent, now going back to the first point that I made, if there is a single source, whomever it may turn out to be, if they in fact are making profits, I would just as soon out of that profit taking use that to pay for the cost that's in this bill. I think we're talking, Mr. Chairman, just in FY15, $2.8 million. And if they stand to make a lot of money relative to being the only source for medical marijuana in Minnesota, then they perhaps ought to contribute to having that opportunity. And if not contribute, then at least keep the price down so that the folks who are in need of this medicinal use that kids have in seizures and things like that, that they benefit from it. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Moline.
Okay, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Moline. I have a few questions, and some related more to the fiscal aspects and some a little bit to the bill, because I know, you know, I'm on the Rules Committee, so we heard a bit about your bill and some testimony on Friday, but some changes have been made since. So I just want to make sure that I'm clear on what you're proposing today. First, with regards to the fiscal note and the fee for participation in the research and access to the medical cannabis, how was the determination made that it looks like about half of, it's estimated about half of the people that would be enrolled in the registry would be $200, so assuming not either on medical assistance or low income, and about half would be. Is that, do you know if that's the experience of other states, that it's been roughly that split, or I'm just wondering how those numbers were reached?
Representative Moline, it looks like, if you'd like to answer, but also it looks like Mr. Greenman from the department may be moving toward the table. I don't know if that was his intent or not. If it wasn't, I guess you are now. But you're one of the people that did work on the fiscal note, so whichever one of you wants to answer Representative Loon's question. Mr. Greenman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the challenges with this fiscal note is not having a lot of experience running a program like this. We took a look at the set of medical conditions that qualify, and we assumed that assuming half of these folks would be in a financial situation, because a lot of these are going to affect their financial situation, we assumed that assuming half would qualify for these programs was not an unreasonable estimate to make. We didn't have a perfect way to go out and calculate what this would be, but we assumed that half was a reasonable number to assume.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So, again, when you say, you know, it may very well be reasonable, I don't know. I guess I'm just asking you how you reached that conclusion. Was that the experience? I noticed you've got some comparative numbers from Arizona. And so was that their experience? So that's based, you know, on what that state has seen, that seemed to be a reasonable conclusion that you came to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, we did base a number of our assumptions on the experience in Arizona. However, one of the things that Arizona didn't provide to us, or we don't have information on, is the percentage of their population that's eligible for some of these programs. One of the issues there even would be that Arizona probably has different eligibility rules for some of the state programs than we do, so it would be difficult to compare our situation to Arizona's.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chair, so, and I think more to Representative Moline now with regards to the bill and the kind of following on a little bit with what Representative Atkins was asking about, but so the patients will pay their either $200 or $50 fee per annually, right, for the registry, and that money will go to the Department of Health in a revolving fund to help pay for the research and the data and et cetera. And then patients will be charged a reasonable fee, And it sounds like sliding based upon patient or family income for the cannabis. Who will determine what's reasonable? And is that, are there going to be some guidelines issued by the Department of Health in that determination?
Rep. Emily.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loon. I think it'll be a determination made between the manufacturer and the Department of Health, which is why we also put the expedited rulemaking in case they need to better guidance on how to determine those fees. But from my understanding, it'll be determined between the manufacturer and the Department of Health. And again, they do have that sliding fee option.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Moline. So just to clarify and make sure I'm understanding, there will be sort of a presentation of a fee scale that the department will have to approve from the manufacturer. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman again from the Health Department. I believe the language does say that one of the factors we consider when we are selecting a manufacturer is the price, the projected prices that they would be charging. I would also add that we would, one thing that's in the fiscal note is a contract with an audit firm to take a look at their prices to make sure that they are reasonable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I appreciate that. And then lastly, more on the fiscal, and then I have a couple of other questions. Will the manufacturer that's selected, and obviously they'll, you know, the fee, we just discussed that, will there be any other than the registry, any other flow of money, whether it be an assessment on the manufacturer or any of the taxes that they will pay as a business? It's my understanding that if they're a for-profit business, they'll be taxed like any other business. Is that correct, Representative Moline?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, I think that there are questions surrounding that. I know that the federal government recently lifted some restrictions as far as taxation and how medical cannabis or cannabis is regulated, because of course we're in the delicate place here, balancing federal law and state law. So right now the assumption is that there isn't taxation. It is also medicine, which, you know, in Minnesota we don't tax medicine, which is why I think that we, you know, stayed away from specifically laying that out in the bill. But right now, it, as it stated on the fiscal note, is there's no anticipated tax revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Moline. All right, well, I just have a couple of other questions that's more related to the relationship of the health practitioner to referring patients to the registry, and that I'm not quite clear on. Generally, you know, if you go in to see a doctor or a nurse or a physician's assistant or something, and you have a condition, a doctor will prescribe perhaps a specific medicine or a pharmaceutical per their diagnosis. And so in reading the bill, it sounds like the health practitioner must certify that the patient has one of the medical conditions that qualifies for the ability to access the registry and medical cannabis. But is that the same as the physician or health practitioner recommending the use? And is there any liability for those medical practitioners in this? I mean, is this an instance where they're placing or allowing someone to be placed on the registry covered by any malpractice that could possibly erupt from this practice?
Reps. Emily.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loon. And again, this is where we're in the delicate balance of federal law and licensing issues. So from my understanding, doctors, medical practitioners are licensed federally, and that license prevents them from writing what we would traditionally think of as a prescription for medical marijuana, because medical marijuana is a violation. It's a Schedule I drug under federal law. And so that's why we can't allow doctors or practitioners to write what we would think of as a prescription for medical marijuana. So the way that it's set up is they certify that the patient has one of the qualifying conditions set forth in the bill, and that patient then brings the written certification to the Department of Health, and they're enrolled into the patient registry that way. We do have language in the bill regarding civil and criminal liability protections for patients, for parents of patients who may be administering the medication, for state employees, and for practitioners. We also have some language regarding protections of employees who, you know, we know that a lot of employers obviously have, you know, drug policies and stuff where, you know, you could potentially be terminated for using something like marijuana. So we have some protections in there that if you are a patient enrolled in the program, you have protections against any retaliation based on your status as a patient. So we try to get that language in the bill and cover all of our bases, but it's not the traditional doctor writes prescription, you go to the pharmacy, pick it up sort of scenario.
Thank you, Representative Moline and Mr. Chair. And so so with regards to the some immunity or some protections from liability, I mean, would the patient sign something with regards to entering into the registry that they aren't going to hold their, let's say they go into the registry and the use of the medical cannabis doesn't work for them. In fact, they have a very adverse reaction. Are they signing something when they enter that? I'll call it experimental, but and that kind of treatment that they are not going to hold their physician or health practitioner responsible for any adverse reaction they may have.
Oh. thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loon. I knew we had it in the bill. I was just looking for guidance on where it was in the bill, and it's on page 8, that the practitioner provide the patient with information, including disclosure to all patients about the experimental nature of the therapeutic use of medical cannabis, possible risks and side effects of the proposed treatment, and a Tennyson warning. And I think the question was more along the lines of the patient signing a form, which I know is in there as well. If I could just have counsel remind me where in the bill it is. And Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, on page 6, beginning on line 6.24, regards the Department of Health developing a disclosure form that would be signed by the patient, a statement notwithstanding any law to the contrary, that the Commissioner of Health or an employee of the state agency may not be held civilly or criminally liable for any injury, loss of property, personal injury, or death caused by act or omission while acting within the scope of the office of or employment under this section. Patient's acknowledgement that enrollment in a patient registry program is conditional on the patient's agreement to meet all the requirement. So yeah, we provide language that the patient has to sign a form, and also the practitioner has to notify the patient of the potential risks.
Representative Loon, I want to respect your line of questioning, but we have 8 other people on the list, so just as a heads up, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was just going to offer that I have one last question, and I appreciate your latitude on this.
Just want to give others a chance.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Moline, and just on that, I appreciate you pointing that to me. I just have a concern that doesn't appear to be specifically something that protects the doctor or the medical professional. There is protection for Department of Health and some of the researchers, but you know, I'll go back and take another look at that. But just lastly, a question on the observational research, and I'm glad you've kind of renamed this, because you know, it from Rules Committee, it's not really a clinical trial as one would traditionally think of it. But will the research and the data that's being collected compare either symptom relief or improvement of the underlying condition through the use of the medical cannabis versus other forms of treatment? Is that something, is that some data that we're going to receive as part of the research component of this, of your bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, first of all, I want to bring your attention to page 11, bottom of the page, beginning on line 11.28. It does provide for the commissioner, the commissioner's staff, and any health care practitioner are not subject to civil or disciplinary penalties by the Board of Medical Practice or by any business, occupational, or professional licensing board. So I think that takes care of your concern regarding the practitioner liability. And then the regarding the reports that go from the practitioner to the Department of Health on page 8, lines 8.23 to 8.25, report health records of the patient through ongoing treatment of the patient to the commissioner in a manner determined by the commissioner of health. So, you know, I think the health department, obviously, you know, the goal and intent of this bill is to look at the efficacy of the treatment and how they're responding to it and what other medications they're on and how those interact with the treatment. And so I imagine those rules will be promulgated by the commissioner, and then the practitioner, pursuant to this language, will be required to report that to the department so they're able to properly assess the data.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Moline.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and members, I have a question I'm going to ask for the Chair to answer or Mr. Marks later, but before I get to that, I just wanted to say that I like the fact that there's only one manufacturer, and I have no problem with the medical side of this issue. Yeah, there'll be a few bad physicians around, but most of them will do exactly what they should be doing. The downside to the medical marijuana is having people grow it themselves in their backyards, and then you have diversion of the product to other people, and that will not happen here. So I really like that part of the bill. In terms of the federal government has a manufacturer in Louisiana, one for the entire country, and maybe you ought to look at how they distribute what they do.
Not very efficiently.
Yeah, not very efficiently, but assume it's there's rules against diversion of the product. And then my question, Mr. Chair, is it looks to me like there's $4,352,000 of general fund money being spent over the next 3 years, and my question is where is that coming from, and does it come out of my budget or not?
Well, Representative Huntley, I'm not sure if it will be your budget after we adjourn, unless you're reconsidering, but it is out of the general fund, but Mr. Marks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, right now the calculation is in that other bills area, but there is a finite amount of money, so it comes from somewhere, but not specifically Health and Human Services.
Well, Mr. Chair, the $4 million is pretty close to what we've got to give a raise to nursing homes, and it's pretty close to what we have for the raise we're going to give to hospitals.
Okay, we And by the way, you have a little history with this legislation, if I recall.
I was the chief author one time, and I like I said, I support the medical end of this thing.
Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, two quick questions. Number one, for the commissioner, is going to be given broad authority for both prescribing and dosing. Can you, you talk a little bit about how the prescribers are now giving up that authority to the department? Can you talk a little bit about how the dosing is going to be handled? So if I'm a patient, how are they going to determine the dosing and medication for me relative to a child or someone else or elderly patient? Who is going to make that determination within your bill as it's currently written?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, the Commissioner of Health will be putting together a list, a range of recommended dosages for each particular condition that qualifies based on existing medical and scientific research in that regard. And we do require under the bill that the manufacturer have licensed pharmacists employed on site in order to distribute the cannabis to the patient based on their the pharmacist's recommended, based on the recommended dosage that comes from the commissioner for that qualifying medical condition.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Moline. So you're saying that the pharmacist would be the person who determines how much medicine to give a person? There would be a state licensed pharmacist that would work for that would determine that, or would somebody who works, either the commissioner or someone works for the commissioner, determine dosing for individual patients?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, the way that the bill is set up is the commissioner sets a range of dosages that is determined to be beneficial for that qualifying medical condition. You'd actually be surprised, I think, on how much literature there actually already is regarding dosages for different medical conditions. In fact, if you go to the website of the Mayo Clinic, they have an extensive webpage on the recommended dosages for each qualifying condition. So there actually is already a lot of literature that exists currently. So the commissioner sets the range, and then the pharmacist distributes for each individual patient based on that range set by the commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And finally and quickly, just looking at the dollars and cents within the bill, you brought up Medicaid, Medicare, and our state and federal programs that people are eligible for, and you look at that in determining how you charge. Would this be covered under any state program as medicine and reimbursed through any of our programs? And how do you put up a wall? I'm assuming you cannot mix dollars that are going for this with any federal dollars because of the legalities within that. So how do you create separation between those funding streams if we have any mixture of federal dollars within that?
Representative Emily.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. We do have on page 7, line 7.31 to 7.34, nothing in this section requires the medical assistance and Minnesota Care programs to reimburse an enrollee or provider for the costs associated with the medical use of cannabis. So patients who are on Minnesota Care or MA are allowed to have that lower patient registry fee, but we specify that MA and Minnesota Care cannot reimburse them for the costs associated with it, just as nobody's health insurance covers the costs of medical cannabis. It covers you going to the doctor and being treated for your condition, but it doesn't cover the cost of the medicine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to clarify that this is all general fund dollars then that are going to be used for this purpose.
And
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, the general fund dollars are going to the Department of Health, so there's no taxpayer money that goes to the manufacturer or to offset costs of the medicine or anything like that. It goes to the Department of Health to regulate this program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline.
Representative Dittmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moline. I had a couple of my questions were already answered when Representative Loon asked her questions, and now Representative Dean regarding dosage. But Representative Huntley brought up an important point that I had a question for, too, is on page 8, your manufacturer medical cannabis duties, 8.34, all cultivation, harvesting, and manufacturing and packing of cannabis must take place in an enclosed locked facility at a physical address provided by the commissioner during the registration process. Now, would this physical address be in Minnesota? Would it be in another state? Will it be in another country? Where will this medication be manufactured?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dittmer, it would be in Minnesota. So under federal law, it's very important that the manufacturing happen in state. You can't cross state lines. I often get asked that question because there are 21 states that with medical marijuana, and so I often get asked, well, why can't we just bring the medicine to Minnesota? And obviously that would really simplify things because then I probably wouldn't be sitting here today in front of you with a bill. But the fact of the matter is it has to be manufactured in Minnesota. So that's the intent of the language regarding the manufacturer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, well, then will the different manufacturers be coming to put bids in? Or how will the commissioner decide which manufacturer to choose? Which in for the harvesting and the packing of the cannabis.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dittmer, yes, there will be a process where varying manufacturers will be able to put in a bid with the commissioner for approval of that manufacturer in the state. And we do require that the manufacturer look at a number of things when determining who the manufacturer will be. On page 3, the requirements that the commissioner has to look at when determining who the manufacturer will be. I'm sorry, it's really on the top of page 4. Bottom of page 3 and the top of page 4.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McNamara. By the way, just a reminder to members, we are set to convene the House at 11, so if you can keep your questions and comments brief and also allow us a little time to get across the street. Where does Representative McNamara? Okay, you were on the list. I didn't know where you were sitting.
Untraditional seating assignment, Mr. Chair.
Now,
thank you.
I'm looking for you over there.
Yeah, I'm usually on your left. Today I'm on your right but speaking from the left. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move an oral amendment on page 3, line 22, after the first 4, insert up to 6, delete the number 1, and that's my oral amendment. It would delete the one in-state manufacturer for the production and make the commissioner allow up to 6. I'd like to ask Representative Moline, I'm thinking after the word manufacturer, we could write or distribution center point, yeah. Whatever. My concern is the ability to reach these folks that are in outstate Minnesota And at the same point, I think this could put some competition in the market, and yet law enforcement certainly can handle six facilities, I believe. But it would allow, there's the hearing later this afternoon in the appropriate committees. They can't offer an amendment, so I thought it would be appropriate here. I think it would be some cost savings to address Representative Huntley's concern. I think there's an opportunity. It would drive down the price, have more people paying taxes. And I'm wondering, Representative Moline, would you like the word or distribution entered after manufacture?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, just to your oral amendment, I mean, I think, you know, I'm obviously in agreement with you personally. My original bill allowed for 55 locations, so for me to go to six would obviously be something I would be open to. You know, unfortunately, this has been a tremendous balancing act between the interests of public safety and law enforcement's concerns and patient access. And right now, law enforcement is neutral on the bill, which is, I believe, a necessity in order to getting something passed into law this session. They are neutral on the bill under the assumption of there being one manufacturer. Now, perhaps you and I can meet with them before the floor session to see if there is any flexibility there. I do think competition is important. I do have concerns with what the costs are going to be to patients, and you know, I think that perhaps you and I can meet with them before the floor session to see if this, if doing something such as your approach to allow for more manufacturers or more locations would change their position on the bill. I'd be happy to have that meeting with you, but at this time I can't accept your amendment only because I don't know how that would change the their position on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would like to add after manufacturer or distributor, excuse me. And if Mr. Sullivan could read it. And Representative Moline, when I get done, I understand that you may need to be neutral on this amendment because you're trying to do the balancing. Mm-hmm. I think you actually had a better bill a while back. I believe that my solution would be something that law enforcement certainly could accept. And you'll get an opportunity later today in Representative Paymar's and I think Representative Atkins' committee, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it's Representative Lesh.
Representative Lesh and Representative Paymar. So you'll have one lawyer and one non-lawyer, then, and you're a lawyer, so you'll have all the law enforcement there, and that's a more appropriate place to take the testimony. But I think it's a better thing if we don't make it only one and make somebody from Roseau, Minnesota have to figure out a way of loading up their young child or their spouse or something that's suffering from cancer and bring them down. I think it would be a much better way, and I'm hoping you can just be neutral and let this go on a voice vote, and if law enforcement says absolutely no, we can work with them, but I think we should stick a little stronger to where we were, and I appreciate all your work, but Mr. Chair, I guess if Mr. Sullivan, I know you're trying to get a lot done, if he wants to reread it and just an opportunity for a voice vote, I'd like, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would be on page...
I'd like, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would be on page 3 of the DE2. On line 22, delete 1 and insert up to 6, and delete manufacturer and insert manufacturers or distributors.
Okay, does everybody understand the amendment? Is there any discussion? Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'd like to speak against the amendment. First of all, I want to ask the bill's author, is this bill silent on the issue of distribution? Because this says one manufacturer, but is there anything in the bill that describes or narrows the methods of distribution?
Representative Moline.
Chair Carlson and Representative Brinert, I think that the assumption is that it's one location. The location has to be verified by the commissioner, the physical location of the manufacturer. And, you know, I think that the language would probably limit it to one location.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, I guess I'd say my reading doesn't indicate to me that the issue of distribution is addressed at all. And I think we open an issue here that we don't need to open. Having six manufacturers is a quite different issue, and I think much more volatile in terms of the agreements around the bill than the distribution question. So if this bill is indeed silent on distribution, I suggest that the issue of distribution can be addressed in the implementation process independently of the manufacturer. So I don't support this amendment.
In the amendment process as we move on.
Any further discussion on the amendment?
Now, the point that Representative Brinert raises can be addressed as we move on and refine this amendment. I mean, so I don't think it's a problem. I think we're better off going forward with this language than and say that that's what our intention is than just hoping to chance.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I would just urge you to support the McNamara Amendment. We can again, take testimony this afternoon and if there's a fix that needs to be made on the floor, we can do that.
Yes.
Commissioner, you came forward. Did you want to comment on this particular amendment?
Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health. Related to this issue, there are two separate issues, the manufacturer and the distribution.
Yes.
Having more than one manufacturer would create several issues. One is cost, and the other is the quality of any data that we would collect. Wherever you're growing the product, it'll be different from one location to another, from one climate to another, so that the product would be different depending on where it's created. And for us to really evaluate the quality, the content of each of those products would increase the cost. The distribution is another issue. Similarly, if the product is different in each of those manufacturing locations, the observational trial would add a level of complexity and would really decrease the kind of information we'd be collecting from our patient registry and our monitoring system.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Just to that point, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, you're the one that's why I put up 2-6. If you only want one manufacturer, that's your call, and if you want to have a couple distribution points, you can. Yeah. If you feel that's the right way, but you can allow it, and you're the professional at it, and I'm a landscaper that wants to give you the flexibility, so I'm with you.
Much a retired.
I am.
Just two issues.
Okay.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Okay, seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
I think it just passed. Motion carried.
Division.
Division has been called for. All those in favor, please signify by raising your hand.
The will of the committee support the author.
Carly wants to know.
She said the will of the committee.
Yeah. Just
no, let's keep it. No, I don't think you want to change it at this point.
Okay. Opposed?
Not in this. Oh my God! Thank you, God.
The egg power chair.
There we go. That's it.
I'm a no.
Yeah, I think one side was a little louder than the other. My, I do have my hearing aids in. literally. So it's we had 11 yes and 17 no, so the motion fails. But I think for the benefit of members, Representative Moline offered to continue that discussion. I think the concern was whether this would create a problem with the with the compromise with law enforcement.
Yes,
so maybe that discussion can take place, and we can see where it is with the informational hearing that's scheduled for later today. Representative McNamara? Representative
Mary. Mr. Chair, I'll be real quick because I know we're pressed for time, but just a thought, particularly for the commissioner to hear. Perhaps at the next discussion, the committee could discuss ways in which the commissioner can come back with some kind of study, reflection of the efficacy of moving in this direction, assuming that we don't move in this direction. Because clearly, I think what you're seeing here is a real struggle about, you know, what is the right, you know, balancing of issues here. And part of that is we're trying to make that decision to some degree, you know, with a dearth of information. Yeah. And so I think for the perhaps some language, regardless of what we do, providing information back to this legislature about the efficacy, the pros and cons of moving in this direction or doing this direction or even evaluating if we adopt this direction would be appropriate.
Okay, thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Representative Moline, I'm looking at subdivisions 2 and subdivisions 11. And what I'm seeing here is in one section it says that it doesn't permit a person to engage in or prevent the imposition of a civil, criminal, or other penalties for certain actions. Maybe they're driving a school bus under the influence. Maybe they are working in a correctional facility with a weapon within their possession and they are under the influence and so forth. But then when you also look at subdivision 11 on, on page 11, so you go from page 2 to page 11, then it gives certain protections for the folks that says for these purposes they are not violating for having use or possession of marijuana and if they're part of the registry program, and it gives them an exemption essentially. So as I see these two subdivisions, they're basically canceling them out. So can you tell me how you rectify this, and does this really mean that a person could be operating a school bus under the influence, provided that they're part of the registry, provided that they've met all those other hoops that are part of Subdivision 11?
Rep. Semolin.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. The 609A, the criminal statutes, already prevent people from operating motor vehicles when they're impaired. None of that would change under this bill. It's just like any prescription medication you have. If you're prescribed to have Oxycontin or something, perhaps your doctor wrote you that prescription and legally you're able to take it, but that doesn't mean that you can be impaired and get behind the wheel. And that wouldn't be any different under this language. Driving impaired, operating any sort of motor vehicle impaired would remain illegal under current law.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, then can you tell me the circumstance in which Subdivision 11 would apply? Can you give me three examples of where Subdivision would apply and that an individual that had was either using, or they were under the influence, or possessing medical marijuana, what would that allow them to do?
Moline. Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, Chapter 152 goes to possession rather than use. So under our current drug enforcement laws, it's the possession that's the criminal activity. So this provides the protections for the possession of the medical cannabis by the patient or the parent of the patient who's administering the medication or the manufacturer. So that's why the word possession is used, because under our current drug enforcement laws, it's the possession that's the criminal activity as opposed to the use.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, but that's where I'm coming into I'm trying to ask you to help me through this, though, because your language doesn't just say possession. It also says use. It also says protection for the title of the Subdivision 11 says protections for registry program participation, criminal and civil. So then I'm assuming that if this individual had use or possession, that they would be off the hook, provided as long as they're part of the registry program. And if you don't have the answer right now, if you can have your staff talk to me offline, that would be fine.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's only under Chapter 152. So, again, the use under 609A, the criminal statutes, if you were still impaired because you were using, that would still be a criminal violation. But for the purposes of the drug enforcement statutes, you would be immune, protected from liability.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, so if you can give me some examples, you don't have to do this right now, but if you can give me three examples of where they could be impaired and that this would protect them from that. And you can do that later on, because I do have one more question, too, that I wanted to know. And this maybe is not something that you can answer, but perhaps the Department of the Commissioner can answer this question. Earlier you had talked about the dosage. Representative Dean had mentioned we understand that the commissioner now is going to be the one that will determine the dosages rather than a physician. So does this mean that rather than, you know, the typical situation where you go into your doctor and the doctor says to you, here's the dosage that you should take, they base that off of what your medical history is and what your interactions have been to other drugs that you maybe have tried. Does the commissioner have that data to know what your interactions have been, all the other medicines that you're taking? And then also, if I understand correctly, the language that we have in this bill doesn't have any liability for the commissioner if he gets that wrong and something bad happens. I assume that family, if their child takes something and it's more than what they should have or it's a negative drug interaction, I'm assuming that family has no recourse against the commissioner if their child gets seriously ill or worse. Can you kind of talk through that piece for me,
well,
please?
Why should they?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, what the practitioner reports to the commissioner is partially going to be determined by the Department of Health. So if that means what other medications the patient is on, how the medical cannabis is interacting with other medications that the patient is on, that certainly is information that will be going from the practitioner to the Department of Health. Now, those are protected records. It's not something that goes to the manufacturer or is distributed to be used in a manner other than, you know, what's prescribed. But again, the pharmacists who are employed by the manufacturer are the ones that would be determining that dosage for the patient based on the range provided for by the commissioner.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, one quick follow-up. If I understand this correctly, then the manufacturer, we don't have a designation as far as how many pharmacists they need to have on hand, but we do know, at least by the fiscal note, that we're expecting 5,045 people each month that will be asking for this dosage. Do we know if the, is it prescribed in your bill, and I just missed it, that says that the manufacturer has to have a ratio of how many pharmacists given the 5,045 number, so that we're making sure that they're doing due diligence to look through this and making sure that people aren't getting wrong dosages that end in serious consequences.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we don't prescribe in law that they have to have a certain amount of pharmacists, but we do state in the bill that it's only the pharmacist that can distribute it to the patient. So I think obviously if there's 5,000 patients, it would be in the manufacturer's best interest to have more than one there. You know, I'm not sure why they would have only one, being that they would be handling 5,000 patients. So we don't require that they have a certain amount. We just require that it's a licensed pharmacist that provides it to the patient.
Okay, we have two more people, and the clock is running, so I'll recognize those two. One is Representative Mahoney, and then Representative Abler indicated earlier he had a question of the commissioner, but if that could be brief. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moline. I think you know how I feel about your bill. I wish it was a bit more expansive, so I'll just leave it at that. My question, though, comes in many jobs in today's world, you have to take a drug test. And some of the conditions in your bill that are enabled by your bill to use medical cannabis you could still do, and we'd have to take drug tests. I don't know that you've likely had conversations with HR people, but that might be a place in the next short period of time you have, is how that would work out. Because drug tests are so predominant in today's employment field that it is, I mean, every construction worker has a drug test. Every temp person has a drug test. I could go on, there's at least a dozen off the top of my head. So something that you need to address before you get the program in place and then all of a sudden find out. So that's my only concern.
And Rep. Simoline.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, on page 12 there is language regarding the person's status as a patient in regards to employment, lines 12.11 to 12.25, and it says, unless a failure to do so would violate federal law or regulations or cause an employer to lose a monetary or licensing-related benefit under federal law or regulations, an employer may not discriminate against a person in hiring, termination, or any other condition of employment. So we did try to address that issue in the bill.
And Mr. Chair, I understand in terms of someone who is already hired and being discriminated against, but in my career it was not uncommon for me to show up at five or six different job sites throughout a year, and work for a month or 2 months or whatever, and every one of those you had a pre-hire drug test, and I believe under your bill Parkinson's disease might very well be covered, and a variety, Crohn's disease and a couple of others, and I know construction workers that have both of those particular, not together, but have those particular affiliations, afflictions, and they would very likely be screened out. So I don't think it's a reason to hold up your bill. I just think it's a reason that people need to think about in the background.
Rep. Simoline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, maybe we can work together to refine the language. I do think that the scenario that you're raising, we have the language that protect that. It says they can't be discriminated based on hiring either. They can't use the medical cannabis on site of the employer, and they can't be impaired, but they're protected against discrimination for purposes of hiring.
Okay, Representative Abler and the Commissioner.
Yeah, if the Commissioner could come down, Mr. Chair. And so just I want to point out to the fiscal note, actually he's going to be sued seven times in the next couple of years, according to the fiscal note on page 7. So he's eager about that. But and so, you know, to the process, just a comment, this is actually a really important bill. It's moved in a way to satisfy a lot of my concerns, and I appreciate that. Unfortunately, a lot of the issues will be worked out in hallway hearings and not in front of committees that can actually act. But at least I want him to go on record, if you will, testifying that he's comfortable or uncomfortable with this bill, and they think that his department actually can do it.
Commissioner, and briefly.
Mr. Chair, members, we've certainly been working with the author and her staff on trying to get this bill to be in a place that we can comfortably implement it, if that is the decision of the legislature and the governor to put this forward. Certainly we have some concerns. One of the issues raised is the dosing, and we are working, my reading of the bill based on this conversation is that there's not enough information about cannabis and its effect, the dosage, its drug interactions, that I could make a recommendation on the dosage, even on the range of dosage. I would have, my reading of the bill is that I can produce some information that is out there in the literature, but the decision is really made by the patient in consultation with his or her provider and with the pharmacist.
One more.
That within what the knowledge base is out there, but there's no good, I would not be comfortable making recommendation on dosage, recommendations on drug interactions. That is more of an individual kind of thing. With that kind of proviso, I think there are some concerns with the physician, and I think the medical association may have some concerns that they may want to address about what an individual provider can do and what concerns there. But with those provisions, if it's the will of the legislature and the governor that this goes forward, and it does go forward, we certainly will implement it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to note that and just the obvious, but a lot of groups that would want to testify about this have not been able to, and so we'll have to, that's what you have representatives for, but it's a, it'll be the committee of the whole on the floor, whether it is or not, and I hope that those people with thoughts and interests will be talking to us from the physician side, et cetera. And I know the Representative Moline has been very open to suggestions, and I commend her for her work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and Representative Abler, just as a reminder, at 5:30 tonight, there is an informational hearing. They will not have the bill in their possession, but I suspect as a result of those discussions, if there were meaningful needed amendments, then they could be offered on the House floor.
Glad you're doing that.
So I can't speculate on what that means.
That's a good thing, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, and I would renew my motion that Senate File 2470, the first unofficial engrossment as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Any further discussion? Representative Kahn.
Yeah, well, Commissioner, I'd just like to say the frustration about no knowledge on dosage is totally due to the federal government's observed and the state government's observed laws on this. There's been no ability to do the kind of research that should have been done.
Okay, any further discussion? Okay, seeing none then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Thank you, Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That meeting.